When he rode past, I seen he was carrying fire and a horn the way people used to do, and I could see the horn from the light inside of it, about the color of the moon. And in the dream, I knew that he was going on ahead. He's fixing to make a fire somewhere out there and all that dark and all that cold. I knew that whenever I got there, he'd be there. Then I woke up.
The gentleman discussed the literary works of Cormac McCarthy on episode 24 of the Cut Print Film Podcast. Here are your hosts, Jeff, Dave, and Chris.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Cut Print Film Podcast, episode 24. I'm Jeff Rollins.
I'm Chris Evangelista. Yes.
And I'm Dave Costell.
Oh, we did it.
It only took us 24 episodes.
I figured I would start the episode with some enthusiasm, so maybe you guys would jump in.
It's episode 24. Later on, Kiefer Sutherland's going to be stopping by.
Who's that? Dave had a stroke while saying that name.
Dave was having all of his teeth pulled
in the middle of by my dentist, Dr. Jafar.
That's not an easy one to say, Kiefer Sutherland.
No, it's also not a real name. Yeah. I'm going to name my daughter Kiefer. This is episode 24, and today we are discussing the film adaptations of Cormac McCarthy, the American author who is responsible for Blood Meridian, The Road, what else? Child of God, All the Pretty Horses.
No Country for Old Men.
Are we talking about books or movies?
We're talking about the movie. Okay. Maybe not books.
I'm just listing the things he's written. Right. He's a well-known author.
I've never read.
He signed a few checks, probably. You know, yes. Stuff like that he's written.
What haven't you read?
I'm like actually saving some of his novels for when I'm like 40 and have nothing else to do because he's going to be dead soon.
Yeah.
Are you imagining you're going to retire at 40? What dream world are you living in?
He's living in the America of the 50s.
No, I'm just.
Well, I mean, I'm going to be dead while I'm 49, right? That's what happened in the 50s.
I'm assuming I'll be all out of good books by then. I'll be like, all right, I got to go read The Orchard Keeper. It's time to read Sutri.
See, that's on my list of things I got to read too. But I've read all of the books that have been adapted, aside from the very first movie that was adapted, is All the Pretty Horses.
Yeah, I have not read All the Pretty Horses.
Haven't read it, but you have, Dave.
It's a very good novel.
I'm sure it is, because let's get this out of the way. Cormac McCarthy is a great writer.
Yes, a master of the craft.
He's such a good writer that apparently filmmakers don't know how the fuck to adapt his books.
Nope.
touching on All the Pretty Horses, like, I feel bad for you guys, because the cinemization, is that a word?
No, but go with it. Go for it. The cinemization,
it is now.
Of the it Cinnabonation.
Makes
of
it seem... I could smell it across the room. It makes it seem very Hollywood and like just cleaner than it is in the novel. Like,
It's like a bunch of people playing cowboys. It doesn't seem real.
Are we starting?
Yeah,
let's start. Yeah,
because that is the first one.
The thing I want to say about All the Pretty Horses, like the novel, kind of feels like The Fellowship of the Ring in the same like way, where it starts out kind of like
jolly,
and then gets like real serious. But in the movie version, it never like kicks up to that next notch. It just like
it gets
bland almost.
That was my big problem with the movie. It's really uneven, and like you can tell there's good ideas that this was based on, but it was directed by Billy Bob Thornton after he directed Sling Blade,
right.
Which is great.
Great before movie. He directed nothing else ever again.
Well.
I'm not positive.
He's directed several things, but none of them have ever...
Trapped in Paradise?
Sure. Sure.
No, I don't think he directed...
Alien 3, I believe.
Just contributing movies to Billy Bob Thornton. Schindler's List.
He did The Thin Red Line, if I'm not mistaken.
But Thornton Here's a Who?
Yeah, he did that one.
Here's a Who?
All the Pretty Horses, it stars Matt Damon... And Penelope Cruz.
Matt Damon, when he was freakishly skinny. It was kind of distracting.
Yeah, he was very skinny. He didn't have an ounce of fat on him.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I said that the film's uneven, and that is my main problem with it. But the other problem is that Matt Damon and Penelope Cruz are playing teenagers,
yeah,
but they are both noticeably 30 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not fooling anybody. I don't know why they were cast.
And that's something totally lost in the film too. Like they're supposed to be running away from home, and in this movie it's version, like, it just feels like a couple of guys.
Well,
going
we
out.
Grew up. I guess we all just go be cowboys.
Yeah, we should move out of our parents' house.
It's Will Hunting and Elliot from E.T.
Yeah, like
that's him, Henry Thomas.
Yeah, I looked that up because I was like, wow, what? I've never seen this guy before. And, yes, I have.
He's not a bad actor.
Pretty
no,
good.
No, he's fine.
And I like that character, too. Yeah. What was his name? Something Rawlings.
Isn't it Lacey or something?
Yeah,
like that?
Lacey Rawlings.
Yeah. And that was a good character.
Your brethren.
No, that's a fictional character.
Oh, you're not descended from Lacey Robbins?
Nope, I'm a real human.
I remember when I first started reading that, we were friends at the time, mm-hmm. and I was like, it's like me and Jeff if we were cowboys.
Yeah, not really.
Except I get stabbed in a Mexican prison.
Oh, and that scene, that's something I want to talk about. Where in the movie, it's some kind of weird, like, Mexican concentration camp.
Yeah, it's not really explained. What is this? It's almost like a fictional prison like Oz, where there's no rules. But this takes place in the 50s. So I know Mexico is not the same as the United States, but surely there's some type of rules in prison.
Right. Well, that's the other thing. They're pretty goddamn deep into Mexico by that point. And in the movie, it seems like they're
just over the border.
Yeah, because when they get to the stables where they start doing the Mustang, like, taming, that's like Act 3. But somehow
it's the middle of the movie.
It seems like they cross the border and they're there.
Yeah.
But that prison scene where he in the cafeteria, like, that is brutal in the book, and in the movie it's just like it's so just
it's
phony.
Lame.
Yeah.
It's lame. It's almost like something out of Saved by the Bell.
Yeah.
It feels like. It's just really strangely.
That's funny you say that, because I did get that feeling.
It's like an after school special or something about bullying or fighting. It's very it's very odd.
He in the novel, he fights off like six giant Mexican dudes with a metal lunch tray.
Hey, that doesn't happen in the movie.
Yeah, it's so brutal. Like, he beats one to death with his lunch tray.
Right, and then Liam Neeson comes and tells him to find a flower. Oh, I'm thinking of Batman Begins. Yeah. I'm sorry. I hadn't seen this film, so I watched it as show prep, I guess. And the first like 20 minutes or
go
so,
go show,
yeah. The first 20
prep rally.
Jesus, I would like you to leave.
It's also not called prep rally, but anyway. So the first 20. Oh.
Look, I'm one drink in at the beginning here.
The first 20 minutes or so of the movie, I was digging it because it was a really arty sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's
I had no problem with the first half of the film.
It was interestingly directed. Like, the way it sort of just, like, it was sort of this lazy sort of way it drifted from scene to scene. Mm-hmm. And I liked that. But after a while, I was like, I am sick of this. Enough.
Well, good for you. They stopped directing like that. And the pace of the film changes drastically. Yeah. And also the directing style.
Right.
Because all of a sudden there are... what was up with that hard cut after Blevins gets killed? There's a freeze frame, and then it dissolves.
Well,
That
is terrible.
It seems like the movie pauses.
Yeah.
Because the music stops and everything.
Let's give, so this is some context. Apparently the original cut of this film was 3 hours and 40 minutes long.
Okay.
And,
this is a 2 hour movie.
So, and Miramax basically said, fuck you, Billy Bob Thornton. No. And they cut the movie down. So a lot of the problems with the movie could be because, you know, it was just cut to hell, but also
the scenes don't work.
Yeah.
Too.
I mean, what's on the screen doesn't work as is, but maybe it would work better.
Yeah. I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt by saying that an extra hour and 45 minutes might have made this film a little more digestible. I know that's a lot of movie to watch, but it's a long story, correct?
Yeah, it's part one of a trilogy, too. Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Is that Sutri's in that trilogy?
No, it's...
Cities on the Plain,
that's
isn't that right?
And isn't The
that...
Crossing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's called the Border Trilogy.
That's,
I've never
okay.
read the other two. Yeah, but it's... I don't know. There's something wrong with it, and I think it's the Hollywoodness of it.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, it's trying to both be an art film and also like a commercial movie at the same time. And that's sort of the problem, because you can't do that. Not, you know, some people could probably pull it off, but apparently not Billy Bob Thornton.
And it gets wrapped up real tight. There's a nice little bow on top.
Right.
And I mean, I know it's based on the novel. Does the novel end neatly.
Well, Blevins dies in the novel.
Right.
And there's a really cool thing in the novel where, you know how they mention it once, like, oh, that's a fake name, but like they never really know if that's actually his name. And Matt Damon goes around Texas like trying to find his family for a while. And he can't find anyone named Blevins in the entire state. It's kind of cool. But it does kind of end on like an aw shucks. Like they walk up to the house together and they're like, oh, hey, you're back.
Got your horse. Just a couple of shit kickers.
And it's like, oh, dad was real mad at me for leaving. Like it does end on that. Like, and it's strange.
Hey, did you forget that you were stabbed in a Mexican prison?
It is a strange thing for a McCarthy novel. And I think he was trying to write something that wasn't like, that didn't make you want to crawl into a grave when you were done reading it.
Yeah, not yet. He hadn't gotten to that point yet in his career.
All right. So, I mean, there's not much I can really say about All the Pretty Horses.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend it. Like, if you've never seen it, I wouldn't recommend watching it.
I would recommend at least watching it if you're a completist, but do not start with this movie.
It's kind of like a forgotten movie, because I remember when it came out, they were trying to sell the hell out of it, and they kept trying to push it as, like, this Oscar movie.
Like an Academy, yeah.
But all the critics just hated it. And then now, like, I don't think anyone remembers this movie.
That's because the next McCarthy novel wasn't adapted till 7 years later.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. Like, I didn't really realize... I didn't realize this was like the first McCarthy movie in like to hit the screen, basically.
Before we move on to the next one, I would say that this is like the most pedestrian
of all,
novel. You like, it's not as like dense and poetic, but so if like you're not like, it's a good Cormac McCarthy primer to get you into it
to read,
because there's still beautiful passages and shit that like makes you think on your own existence.
You're talking about the book, though.
Yeah, the book.
Part of the reason I haven't read it yet is because I have like OCD, and like because I know it's part of a trilogy, I know that once I finish it, I have to read the other two.
Right.
And so like I need to like block out some time for that. So that's why I haven't gotten around to reading it yet.
Yeah, I still haven't read the second one.
Like, I'm the type of person who like, once I find out something is like a trilogy, I'm like, oh fuck, I can't start that right away, because because my OCD kicks in and it won't let me just...
That's why you read the whole Game of Thrones Wikipedia.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Well, you get the gist.
Right.
All right, so
what is the next one, 7 years later?
No Country for Old Men.
Oh, I was going to say the 7-year itch, but yeah.
No, it's not. That came out well before.
So No Country, especially on the back of All the Pretty Horses, shows you everything that was wrong with All the Pretty Horses.
Are we all in agreement in saying that this is the only film to get Cormac McCarthy right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
It hits every single, like, it almost makes the novel better.
I mean, from right off the bat, it's almost scene for scene of the novel.
Yeah, there's
basically
only a couple. There's
one or two Coen-ism things. Oh,
yeah. If you're not familiar with this movie at all somehow, and you're listening to this podcast,
crawl out from under a fucking rock and see the movie.
First of all, I'm confused at who you are and what kind of monster you are.
Yes.
But this was directed by the Coen brothers, and it stars Josh Brolin, Javier Bardem, and Woody Harrelson, among other people.
And Woody Allen.
Yes.
Lou Ellen
Moss.
Moss Davis, I was going to say.
No, not Lou and Davis.
That's the other.
And he's just like a normal dude, and he stumbles across a cartel drug trade gone bad. Right. Everyone's shot to death.
But he finds the briefcase of money, and Javier Bardem plays, what's his name? Anton Chigurh. And he's on the trail trying to collect this money.
And he's a fantastic character, both in the book and in the film.
Great head of hair, too.
Oh, God, yes.
And we're going to get to his head of hair later, too, by the way.
The thing with, and this is what's wrong about All the Pretty Horses, Child of God, The Road, what's the other one?
The Counselor.
The Counselor's a totally different subject.
I can't wait.
That's a whole other ball of wax.
Is that Cormac McCarthy characters, they're not people.
No.
The major characters.
Right.
They're
ideas.
They're entities, almost. And the only one to, like, capture that is No Country for Old Men.
Yeah, with that Anton Chigurh character. Chigurh. Absolutely.
And the sheriff is right there as like
Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah, Tommy Lee Jones plays. I totally forget his name.
Ed Tom Bell is his.
That's
name.
It. I knew it was. He had three names.
And he is fantastic in this.
Yeah, Tommy Lee Jones.
He's a great actor in general, but he's really good in this.
He steals every scene he's in.
Yeah,
yeah. It's without a doubt my favorite Tommy Lee Jones movie.
Mm-hmm.
He's. Did he win the Academy
Batman
Award
Forever
for
is excellent, though.
Yeah, yeah, he was really good as Two-Face in Batman
He's
Forever.
Oh, yeah.
And no, he wasn't.
And in that movie, The Missing. No, that movie was terrible.
The movie is the worst.
That is not a good film.
The Ron Howard film, The Missing.
Not a good film at all.
Anyway.
He
didn't win the Academy Award for this, but
was he in Space Truckers?
He was in Space Cowboys.
That's what I'm thinking.
Space Truckers
Cowboys.
Is Dennis Hopper.
All right, we're gonna shift gears and talk
about Space Truckers. When they drove those trucks in space,
boy howdy,
look out!
That about sums that up.
Was it like Joyride? Right,
what
was it like Joyride?
Nothing like Joyride. I'm gonna. Ask
I mean, there
you
was a
leave.
Truck, but it was in space. So,
all right, back to No Country.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about Javier Bardem's haircut?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's dive right in.
It's really zany.
It's great.
Next.
I don't know what we could say about
right,
No
so
Country.
Why do you think this movie works and the other Coen brothers... excuse me. I had a brief moment of insanity. Why do you think this movie works and the other Cormac McCarthy movies do not work?
I think this one captures the brutality of McCarthy
absolutely.
Really well. And I also think it captures the humanity of Llewellyn Moss,
right.
That desperation. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Because like the things he does in the film,
yeah.
they're not outlandish. I think like
no.
that's like what anyone would do in that situation is
yeah.
how he reacts more or less.
He actually is a little smarter than your average person
because right.
he does awesome. Like
he
does sneaky things.
Work.
Yeah, like he has skills because he was a Vietnam vet,
right? Yes.
But. I think one of the main things is that it's the only one to capture like that McCarthy's dialogue is poetic in mm-hmm. nature a little bit, like slightly. And it delivers on that without being like someone's reading lines from a novel.
Right.
To
yeah, that's because you
like
have
that.
People reading lines that know how to read lines.
Right.
Yeah.
That is the I'm going to say that's a major difference between this film and all the other ones.
And this is a movie, it's not afraid of silence. There's no actual soundtrack in this movie. There's no score. It's all just natural sounds.
Yeah.
And just characters pause in between what they're saying. And it's just, a lot of movies are afraid to do that because fucking humanity has descended into the toilet and people don't understand silence anymore. So people get uncomfortable with silence.
Yeah.
But this movie is not afraid to just be silent.
This film was up for Best Picture along with There Will Be Blood
right.
that year.
And this
and
won.
This won. And I think one of the reasons it won, I would have picked There Will Be Blood, but I think one of the reasons this won out is because of that sound, that lack of soundtrack.
Right.
Whereas There Will Be Blood had long pauses where characters don't say anything, but the silence is filled with Johnny Greenwood's droning score.
Yeah,
for the film,
his horror movie score.
Which is fantastic.
It is.
And
it's great.
And that's one of the things I love about There Will Be Blood, but I think the public in general, or at least the Academy in general, liked that the Coen brothers used that silence to their benefit.
It was kind of interesting because
effective.
This and There Will Be Blood, they're really similar tonally, mm-hmm. I would say, and they both have that like that western sort of desert feel to them, obviously.
Yeah.
And I think this is the more commercial of those two films, so that's another reason why it won Best Picture.
Yeah,
like, even though I don't think this is a very commercial movie, when you compare it to There Will Be Blood, this is the more commercial movie.
Yeah. Because this has the kookiness.
Right.
Of,
and it's got action in it. There's no action in There Will Be Blood, really.
No.
I mean, so.
Yeah, No Country is also not afraid. Because one of the main staples of a McCarthy novel is sometimes you'll flip the page, you'll read it, and you'll have no idea what you just fucking read.
Yeah.
You'll be like, where are these people? What's happening?
Was this a quotation?
Yeah.
Because
right.
he doesn't use punctuation
no,
at all.
Not at all.
Yes. Yeah.
But. No Country isn't afraid to just throw scenes at you without establishing them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a scene where Tommy Lee Jones goes to visit his father.
I think it's like his uncle, actually.
Is it his uncle?
Yeah.
I always assumed it was his father,
so
but I don't know why.
No, because he says his father is
yeah.
dead earlier.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
So I think it's either his uncle
or his grandfather.
Something like that, yeah.
For some reason, I got the impression it was his grandfather because, like, he was once sheriff.
Right.
And then his dad was sheriff, and then he's sheriff.
He has a lot of cats. Let's just say that. He's a guy with a lot of cats.
The mere fact that we don't know, like we're arguing over who this character is, proves that point.
Because
like,
the movie, it doesn't care about establishing who he is, because it's not important. It's just, all that matters is the scene that's going on.
Is what is happening. Right. Yeah.
And McCarthy does that well in his novels.
Oh, yeah.
Like he just, here's two characters, you do the homework, you figure out who's who.
I'm thinking maybe that's an issue too, because these are interpretive passages you're reading, mm-hmm. and then when somebody else interprets them for you on the screen and it doesn't match, because that's a lot of my issue with The Road is done well for a movie, but The Road in my head is a totally different thing than
It's Cormac McCarthy. That was a weird way I said that. Cormac McCarthy. He doesn't spoon feed you, I guess is like the best way you could put it. Mm-hmm. Like with his writing.
Sometimes he does when I'm having trouble eating.
Yeah. He's just trying to help out.
Yeah, when you're really tired and you can't lift your arms, he comes over and he spoon feeds you porridge.
And you haven't put your veneers in.
Someone probably spoon feeds him, though. He's like 900 years old.
Yeah, he's that old. He's literally that old.
He's from the Old Testament.
But he's not afraid of letting the reader figure shit out on their own. And that doesn't work for a lot of filmmakers, because a lot of filmmakers, they're concerned with, again, how stupid the audience is.
Yeah, and that I remember, or I don't remember. I sent Chris this thing where James Franco was talking about
I was going to bring this up. God.
How he was asking Cormac McCarthy, like, what the motivations of Lester Ballard, a character from Child of God.
Basically, he was like, what happened to Lester when he was a child? This is Child of God, which we'll get to. He said, what happened to Lester when he's a child? For those of you who don't know, the character of Lester Ballard in the book and the film, he's this fucking outcast who basically has sex with corpses.
Yeah.
So James Franco, when he went out to make Child of God the film, he basically called up Cormac McCarthy and he said, oh, what happened to this character when he was a kid that made him this way? And Cormac McCarthy said, no, he's just this way. And James Franco said, oh, I don't want to make a movie about just a psychopath. And it's like, you're an idiot. You're missing the entire point.
We're going to get to Child of God,
but
I want to relate that to the film American Psycho.
Right.
When that came out on DVD, I watched the commentary track with the director, and she said that every actor that she auditioned for the part of Patrick Bateman was trying to go method with it and like try and get inside his head and figure out what made him this way. And Christian Bale is the only one that came in and said, well, he's just a blank slate. There's nothing to this guy. And she's like, yes, that's correct.
I mean, that's the whole point.
Yeah. So, and that is basically the problem with Child of God, the way Franco approached this project. He missed the ball right before he even started making the film. He didn't understand what he was doing.
But what I was getting to is James was like, James, because we're on a first name basis.
Yeah, your buddy James.
Jimbo Django.
James Franco, in that exchange, he was like, I don't know, maybe he was like abused. Was he abused or something? He was saying this to Cormac McCarthy on the telephone. And Cormac McCarthy just said something like, I don't know, James. Because it's for the reader to interpret,
when I picture this in my head, I picture James Franco on a cell phone and Cormac McCarthy on the old Alexander Graham Bell phone.
He has to dial an operator to get an outside line.
That's what I'm picturing.
Jenny, could you patch me into the police? James Franco's on the line again.
Because when I picture Cormac McCarthy, I don't picture him as someone who talks to James Franco.
No.
He shouldn't. They shouldn't know each other.
Well, do you know anything about Cormac McCarthy? Like, have you ever read about what he does?
I don't want to know, but tell me.
I believe he's a Sagittarius.
Yeah. Well, he lives out in New Mexico he has a rather young wife.
Oh, really?
And
good for him.
At the time he wrote The Road, he had a son that age. That's why he wrote it. But he goes to the University of New Mexico, Santa Fe, something like that.
You think he would have graduated by now?
No.
He's like Jim Belushi in Animal House. He's just the world's oldest college student. No. Food fight! Not again, McCarthy!
He keeps scrapping that food fight novel because they won't publish it. They have one of the most noted astrophysics departments, and he just hangs out with astrophysicists all day, talking to them, because they're the only people he's interested in.
Okay.
He's so
I can see that.
He's so above us all.
Well, this is a guy that did extensive research before writing Blood Meridian, which we'll get into Blood Meridian after we do these film adaptations.
And I'll have more biographical notes on Cormac McCarthy.
Perfect.
We do
that. All right.
So,
Do you want to do a break real quick and we'll come back with The Road?
Sure.
And
are we done with No Country? Because I just wanted to touch on that.
Be soft.
It is America, though. No Country.
I wanted to slap on.
Come on now.
That ending, not the last scene with Tommy Lee Jones, but the fact that Josh Brolin's character, who we follow through the whole film, spoiler, he dies completely off screen,
which I love,
and that's in the book. That's the one sort of thing that's different in the book, because in the book he picks up like a hitchhiker,
like a 16-year-old.
Yeah, she's
girl.
Like a teen girl, and they're sort of like flirty. And the movie doesn't do that, which is fine. But it's the same thing, though. He dies just completely off page, and then he dies off screen in the film. And I love that. And I remember I saw this movie in the theater, and there's a scene where a character pulls up, and they find Josh Brolin's body. And I heard everyone in the audience around me gasp, and I was like, fuck, that's good.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
That's good that it elicits that reaction of you, because that's so unheard of to like just kill the main character and off screen.
And it's cool because that character's not there. She's like floating in the pool dead.
Right.
Like you see her for a second.
Right.
So she was in the movie.
Right. That's a little like tidbit for them.
But the whole point of that is that she kind of throws him off his game because he's up to this point is doing very well dodging these people.
And he's on his own.
And then he's kind of like protecting her a little bit. And he gets, you know, gunned down by these dudes. And it's so awesome because it's like you just miss him getting killed in the movie. Like the pickup truck pulls out and there's like a fucking Mexican guy falls off of it.
Yeah, the Coen brothers treated
the other thing,
with respect when they made the film.
It's not even the fact that Chigurh kills Josh Brolin. He's killed by characters we don't even know anything about. Yeah. That's the other thing.
Just Mexican gangsters.
They're just unnamed Mexican gangsters kill him off screen.
And that's such a cool thing because I can like kind of see Joel watching their commentary and all and like interviews with them. I could see them like making that up on the fly, like let's not even fucking show him die. Like it just is such a cool directorial decision.
Yeah,
if that's a word, directorial.
It is.
That is a word. I like that word earlier.
You got yourself a word this time.
Yeah.
Ding ding ding.
Right, with that victory, let's go to break.
All right, we'll be right back with The Road
and The Ring. Oh no, sorry.
Child of God. Then we will touch on Cormac McCarthy's screenplay, The Counselor.
And then we'll
talk about the unmakeable movie, Blood Meridian.
Yes.
Bud Meridian. About Air Bud.
It's about the Bud Bowl.
It's just Budweiser's all day. All right. Be right back. BRB, as they say.
Here at Cutprint Film, we do our very best to keep you in tune with the movie industry. We're revolutionizing the way you read movie reviews by putting them on the internet. Go to cutprintfilm.com and we will guarantee you a pleasant experience. We're breaking new ground every day to bring you the finest material possible. We've partnered with such clients as morelikeradio.com, antifanboy.com, and Joystick Jerks, the podcast. So check out all of that and more on cutprintfilm.com. And remember, have a Cutprint Film day.
Well, look. Hey.
Hey, everybody. We're back.
We're back to some freaky music.
Back in a big, big way, as far as I'm concerned.
Dave, what music is this from?
This is from The Nick, starring Clive Owen. You can hear me over it.
It's the new show on, what was it on? I already forget.
Skinamax.
That's not a channel. It's on Cinemax. Is this getting louder somehow?
It's getting more intense, Jeff.
I'm turning it up. That's how it's getting. The Nick is a very good show. But
directed by Steven Soderbergh.
Cormac McCarthy.
Yeah.
But there's not really any appropriate Cormac McCarthy music.
No, there's weeping.
There's that Cormac McCarthy rap song.
Or there's the endless banjo from Child of God.
Yeah.
But
Well, we're going to get to that.
Yeah.
But first,
let's get to The Road. 2009's The Road, directed by John Hillcoat, who you may know as a music video director. He did work for Nick Cave and INXS. So also, who else would you pick for your Cormac McCarthy adaptation?
Also, he owns the Burlington Coat Factory, I believe. Jonathan Hillcoat.
He also did...
He did the Proposition, yeah, which I think is a cool movie,
yeah.
Which was written by Nick Cave.
Yeah, well, I love Nick Cave's music. I'm not a big fan of his literary work.
I never read any of his books. I like The Proposition. Mm. Do you like The Proposition? Have you seen it?
I have not seen
it. It's good.
It's really violent, so that's kind of... It's like shockingly violent, right. Which is...
Well, Nick Cave's dark, but his latest book, The Death of Bunny Monroe,
right.
Is... nearly unreadable.
I have not dipped my toe into the Nick Cave literary works.
Into the cave of Nick Cave?
Yes, I have not ventured into the cave of Nick Cave.
If you watch The Proposition, yeah. And then I told you, that guy's going to make The Road, you would be excited like I was before The Road came out.
Yeah, because The Proposition seems like... The direction of The Proposition seems like it's perfect for The Road.
Mm. But it's not.
Yeah.
And it seems like maybe... See...
Well, let me just preface by saying, I don't think The Road is a terrible movie.
I don't either.
It's okay.
I like the way The Road looks a lot.
I think if The Road were its own movie and not based on the McCarthy novel, it would be a lot better. But once you know what source material it's from, it's kind of disappointing.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Dave, I think you have the strongest opinion on this.
It's so mediocre that makes me more angry than if it had been bad. Because
I think that's like a good way of putting it. Like, it's not good, it's not bad, it's just in between. It's mediocre.
I have a theory, though, that this was made for the Weinstein Company, and Harvey Weinstein is notorious for meddling.
Yes, he is.
I remember when this movie was like being sold to the public, the trailers.
Oh God!
The trailers made it look like this action movie.
Yeah, like this apocalyptic, like this apocalypse is coming.
They made it look like the Dawn of the Dead remake. Basically.
It was the Into the Storm trailer, just.
And they also kept like showing Charlize Theron's character as if she was like this big part of the movie, which she's not.
Which is smart from a marketing standpoint.
Yeah, but
unless you've read the book, like 2% of the population.
Show the sexy babes,
did.
And then.
What's that? Salacious babes?
Salacious.
You show the sexy babes and then you get the 18 to 24.
Get those bikini babes in there. Cormac McCarthy's Bikini Babe Road.
Girls Gone Wild, Cormac McCarthy edition.
They got to have a fundraiser at the Bikini Car Wash, otherwise they're going to close the arcade down.
Written by Cormac McCarthy.
Everyone dies at the end.
I want that to exist. Everyone dies at the end. Well, we didn't say the car wash dies.
So I feel like John Hillcoat was not an established director at this point. So
right.
I feel like he may have been pushed around a little by Harvey.
Well, Harvey likes to throw his weight around.
Harvey Wallbanger.
To get his, yes, it's a delicious drink.
Because that scene in the book where they discover the people in that room.
It's terrifying.
It's
and disgusting.
Right. For those who don't know, The Road, the book, and the film, they're set in a post-apocalyptic wasteland. It's about a father and son. They're just traveling.
Down the coast, essentially.
Right. Yeah. And that's really it. There's no,
yeah, that's it.
It's a father and son story.
Right.
That's what it is. And that's... My wife just read it a couple weeks ago, and I was in the other room, I think, editing this very podcast. Not this episode. That's impossible.
Yeah. Jesus, Jeff.
But I could hear her.
Jeff's
hear
a time cop, by the way.
I could hear her crying. And like that's how powerful the book is.
I cried. I've talked about how I cried onto the pages of The Road, and I was like, oh my God.
Even for McCarthy, it has a different sort of style. It's written in these sort of like little vignettes. It's like it's just different. It's like paragraphs that aren't even connected. It's just like a paragraph,
yeah,
another paragraph.
Like a diary.
Yeah, it's not like it's not written. And we've already established he's a weird quote unquote writer because he doesn't use quote marks and stuff like that.
But putting McCarthy's voice into a 5-year-old kid is what is most powerful, because that kid says stuff in that fucking book that just like hits you right in the throat.
Yeah.
Immediately. Yeah. The second you read it, you're like, oh, it's like, Papa, what were birds like?
Yeah. Like, oh stuff like that. Like just simple 5-word sentences that just like get you. But this movie, it's limp. It's a limp movie.
Yeah. And those moments, like, they're not in the book. Like when they would be sitting there talking and you would feel that connection, that, like, strong, like, even though Viggo Mortensen is, like, a hard dick in this movie. Mm-hmm. Not like a hard penis, but like he's like
it's a little out of character.
I hope not.
He's hard to this kid.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you can see why, because I would argue that the book is told mostly from his perspective.
Who, like the kid?
No, the father. Okay, you feel it
Yeah.
Which is why the ending's a little disjointed and makes you feel, which is genius, you feel the abandonment of the kid when you lose Viggo Mortensen, and it makes that weird transition where all of a sudden it's like not from his perspective as much anymore. But those movies aren't in the book. They're just, they just fall flat. It's like, oh, I don't feel like these two people are actually in love the way
like
they are in the book.
I also think like a big thing that's missing from the movie is like the overall horror of everything.
Oh yeah.
Like the book is horrifying.
Yes, it is.
Because McCarthy has this way of writing. It's just this sparse sort of, he doesn't have to explain a lot. You just get the horror from what he's saying. And the film, you'd think a film will be able to just pull that off because it's a visual medium, but it doesn't. Like, there's a sequence in the book where they find like a basement full of people.
That's the one I was talking about.
Yeah, being kept captive by cannibals. And that in the book, it's terrifying. In the movie, it's sort of like, there's people in a basement. Like, it doesn't fucking feel horrifying.
But it's a living.
Yeah. The dinosaur from the Flintstones is there. It's a cannibal.
Like, part of it is like, he drops the lighter in the book into the cannibal hole.
The cannibal
hole. But like, up to that point, you know,
it's
how
a manhole.
You know how important that lighter is. But in the movie, it's just like he drops a lighter.
We'll get another one. We'll pick another one up at Trader Joe's.
At Ace Hardware's.
But there's also a scene. There's scenes in the book like that are epic.
Right.
Like they're walking down the road and there's just people, hundreds of them, melted into the road. Yeah. Like they're skeletons. And at one point he picks up like a blender and he just is like playing with it and kind of walking. And none of that's in the book. There's another part
that's in the movie.
In the movie, sorry.
Yeah.
Is this? I can't remember if this scene is in the book. I want to say no, but there's a scene in the movie which it takes me out of everything. Where they find like a Coke machine.
Oh, I love that scene.
Is that in the book?
I think so, but it's not even nearly as powerful.
In the movie,
he doesn't say.
In the movie, it's goofy. He's like, "This is for you," and he gives him the Coke, and it's just like,
and it's ice cold, and it fizzes when he opens it.
No, but it's because he's never, like, he doesn't know what that is,
and somehow that
ice cold Coca-Cola.
I do actually remember this in the book, and it works in the book, but in the movie, it's like,
it just come off as goofy in the movie.
It's like, here's the, he's like, "Papa, it's delicious." I think, I guess part of that is the kid playing the boy, Cody Smith. Smith McPhee.
Yeah.
And just in the book, it's fine to hear, to see the word Papa over and over again. But in the movie, to hear a kid say Papa
in
frequently.
2009.
The kid's a little old, too, and that's because like it's hard to get a young actor.
Yeah, you can't get a young kid.
He's not a bad actor.
No, he's good.
He's a good child actor.
It's just, I don't know, something about him in this film rubbed me the wrong way.
That scene is also, like, in the book, it has, like, symbolism to consumerism and, like, you know, like, something that's bygone, and it immediately connects with this kid in a way that, like...
when they both enjoy a delicious Lunchables
snack.
And a Coke.
And a Chef Boyardee. There's also a scene in the book where they come across, like, the baby on the... spit.
Yeah.
And, like, that's fucking horrifying in the book. And in the movie, it's just like...
That's so horrifying that I remember it vividly.
Oh, yeah.
Right, book,
but I don't remember it at all in the movie. At all.
Like, in my head, I'm like, does that happen in the movie? I don't remember it in the movie.
Well, here's the thing about this book that is unique to any other movie I've ever seen as a... Any other book I've ever seen out of the movie is that once I see a movie of a book... It immediately replaces the memories.
You imprint the people, actors, into your memory.
But the road, I still have those original. Yeah. Like
that's because this film is so forgettable.
Oh,
it's utterly inconsequential.
That's actually remarkable.
This film has accomplished this remarkable feat where it just doesn't matter at all. You're watching, you're like, huh, that was something I saw. What did we just watch?
Yeah, I saw this in the theater, and I have no desire to ever watch it again. I didn't hate it. I was just like, well, that was a movie, whatever.
And those scenes when he's like going into the boat in the book, they're like so
cool.
It's powerful. Yeah.
And then in the book, it's like, oh, this guy climbing around on a fucking boat.
Nate, well, he's back.
And then Child of God takes that premise to the ultimate. Like,
yeah, it takes that premise and shoves it right up its own ass. It's
like,
great.
Like the idea, not the premise, but like the idea that like this is just stuff happening. That's what Child of God feels
do
like.
Do you want to move on to Child of God?
Well, should we do the Counselor? Is that chronologically the Counselor?
That's
before
true.
Child of God.
I thought we would just do that after Child of God. So it's not an actual book.
Yeah, the Counselor feels separate to me.
Is there anything else for The Road? I love Viggo Mortensen as an actor, but for some reason he feels wrong.
He's a fine actor. I don't see him in this role. He would not have been my choice.
Oh, there's a huge issue with this movie, too, where like 20 minutes in, the color correction drops out. And it turns
into
distracting.
Mud. Yeah,
I don't know if they lost funding or something, but like it's not even like it's in the middle of a scene, like while on a guy's face, all of a sudden the colors change, and you're like, is this the fucking Wizard of Oz? Like,
I don't know if they thought they could get away with that because of the flashback scenes, and you wouldn't know the difference. But anybody with eyeballs, I know exactly what you're talking about. It's distracting.
And up to that point, it has like a good hue.
And after that, it's just seaweed mud.
Yeah,
it's horrible.
It just looks like your friend went out on a normal day and filmed the movie. And that does not have an apocalyptic feel.
Or his Android, which, as we all know, is a subpar phone.
In landscape mode.
All right, so moving on to...
Child of God.
Child of God, which came out this year.
Let me preface this by saying I did not bother to watch Child of God.
All right,
because
that concludes our discussion on Child of God.
I love the book. I actually read this book this year, and
it's
remarkable.
There's a sequence in this book where it's literally just Cormac McCarthy describing fireworks going off, and it's one of the most beautiful things I've ever read. And nothing is happening; it's just fireworks. I should have like printed it out to read it, but it's gorgeous. So when I heard James Franco, who I fucking loathe, is making Child of God, I realized I don't want to see this. I have no reason to fucking watch this movie.
And you were right, because I did see it and reviewed it for cutprintfilm.com.
God bless you.
Mother of God, this thing stunk.
I've seen like clips of it, and just from what I watched, it looks like someone took a video camera and filmed just their friends.
Which is what this is.
Yeah, it does, right. it does look like that.
There's nothing cinematic about the movie.
This is directed by James Franco, and it stars his best buddy and I think roommate at the present time, Scott Hayes, as Lester Ballard, who is this kind of like
outcast?
He's a vagabond, an outcast. There's definitely some mental issues. He's removed
like a
golem,
almost.
Yeah, almost.
That's what he...
Like he's completely removed from society, and he's a crazy person.
From the book, just from the book is sort of like it's establishing how just like a mythological monster.
Yeah,
he's
animalistic.
Just can just be created in the people's minds, and that's what the book is.
And it's also like society's creating this monster because no one ever like he's not that bad at first, but you see like the gradual decline is because he keeps being put in these situations that he shouldn't be in. You know what I mean?
Yeah. He's unequipped mentally to handle these situations.
Right.
And yet here he is time and time again.
Yeah. He just keeps going down the rabbit hole of insanity.
He's always going down instead of climbing out of the hole.
Right.
Except for the last, until the end of the book where he literally climbs out
of a hole.
He comes out of the ground like a dead person.
Right. Like Jesus, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
All right, so sell me on Child of God,
I can't,
guys.
Because this is a dreadful film.
Well, I want to say this before we destroy the film. If you have... Like, if you really want to read something, and you have... This is a short. You can read this in 2 days.
It's really...
200 pages?
It's not that long.
It is beautiful and horrifying at the same time.
This is... I would say to anybody, if you're going to start with Cormac McCarthy...
McCarthy.
And then drink
Cormac
some coffee.
Yeah, drink a cup of coffee.
He doesn't have a cup of coffee.
Yeah, if you're going to start reading Cormac McCarthy, start with Child of God, I would say. It's a easy read, but it's him at his most brutal.
Yeah, I would say, like, if you're squeamish, go with All the Pretty Horses.
The main character has sex with corpses, so this is not like...
Right, it's a brutal read, but it's a fast read.
It's accessible while also being horrifying.
And it's also a fascinating read, and it's not... Like a book like Blood Meridian, that's a dense read.
Yeah, don't start with Blood Meridian, even though that's I think his best novel. Yeah, we'll get to that. Don't start with that because you will lose your mind.
But yeah, I recommend starting with Child of God, the book, and burning your copy of Child of God, the film.
Rip out the tape of the VHS you have for some reason.
There's a scene in the book that like sticks in it when he's hoisting her up into the attic with the rope, and it's so the movie kept ruining scenes over and over.
The movie has a habit of going the Three Stooges route with a lot of the horrific stuff that he does. Like, he has sex with a corpse in a car, and we see the goddamn car rocking.
Oh, thank God.
Like, it's out of an episode of Beavis and Butthead.
That's how you should frame that fucking shot, you loser.
It's just like everything's played for comedy when it shouldn't, and it doesn't work as comedy, by the way.
No,
but it shouldn't be played for that either.
And the movie's like a lot of yelling. It's just like that's most of the movie.
Yeah,
sounds great.
This is a poor job all around. Well, no, I will say Scott Hayes does a great job as Lester Ballard. Physically, he physically embodies the role.
He's like, he's really good at it. I'll say this as a criticism on the medium, is that he's hard to understand at points.
Yes.
But like with the book, you can kind of like read the line again and then like kind of figure, because it's written like orthographically, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like you're like, you read it and you're like, those aren't words. But then you put it together in your head. But in the book, with this film,
you would have to watch the scenes over and over again, which, listen, I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
I will not watch this ever again.
No one wants you to do that.
I was deep sighing throughout this movie, just like, if you gave
the three of us the same equipment and Scott Hayes, we could have made a better Child of God.
Yeah, this is,
I feel like anyone could have made a better Child of God except James Franco, who doesn't get it.
What, I gave this film a 3 out of 10, and Dave told me I was being generous after watching it.
And I'm a James Franco fan.
Right. He's a Francophile.
Yeah. That's why he's smoking a clove cigarette and drinking coffee with chocolate in it. And he's surrendering.
Nice beret, idiot.
I get it. French.
You know what I'm talking about.
Thank God Dave slowly got it.
What I did like about this film, aside from Scott Hayes' performance, was the cinematography. It looks gorgeous. I mean, they shot this, I think, in the Appalachian Trail. And I love the way it looks.
I mean, do you mean the cinematography or do you mean the scenery? Because from what I've seen from the cinematography, it's garbage.
All right.
This is James Franco.
I just don't want to give Franco
any
credit.
It's very shaky cam for no reason.
This is James Franco's director style. He watched a bunch of John Cassavetes films and he said, "Oh, let me fucking do that.
I can do that."
Yeah, I can fucking handheld all my films even when they don't need it.
But it's
And for the record, John Cassavetes is actually an artist, whereas James Franco is a piece of shit.
But every other actor in the movie just feels like someone who happened to be around.
Yeah, they were walking down the street and they're like, "Yeah, hey, you like movies? Want to be in one?"
Like, there's a scene in the jail in the novel where Lester and the black guy across from him are talking through the bars, and it's very powerful in the novel. And in this, it's just goofy.
It's played for laughs again. It's played for laughs.
Like, the whole time he's singing something in the novel, he's singing, like, "Gonna fly home like a motherfucker."
Right. Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Like, in this, it's like, it's just like the guy was reading off a piece of paper, "Gonna fly home like a motherfucker." Like, it doesn't work at all.
And the melody he's singing is like a modern melody.
Yeah.
This whole scene, I told Dave earlier today that this scene,
like, he's a member of 3-6 Mafia.
Like, the whole movie takes place in the 50s, I think.
Yeah.
And this scene seems like it takes place in 2014. Everything about this film is disjointed.
I said that. Like, the whole film feels like it takes place in a rockabilly convention. Mm-hmm. Like it doesn't.
Yeah, where's Brian Stetzer? Where are the Stray Cats at?
It doesn't feel authentically 50s ever. It just feels like 2014. 50s.
And then here comes a 1950s Ford rolling up to let you know that
like, what the, why are they driving the fucking Ghostbusters mobile?
So yeah, Child of God stinks. Big
it's
time.
Bad.
Put that on your poster.
But read it. It's very good.
Yeah, it's a fantastic novel.
Read the book. It's really good.
Cormac McCarthy did The Sunset Limited, which was a play for HBO, but none of us have ever read it or saw it.
No.
So we're not gonna talk about that. Yeah. It's on HBO Go if
Yeah, maybe it's good. Who knows?
Yeah, we don't know. Certainly not us. Yeah, not the film podcast you're listening to. We didn't watch it.
Yeah, not the film podcast about Cormac McCarthy. We certainly didn't bother to watch this.
Child of God is so bad that if you told me I had to watch one of these movies again, The Counselor or Child of God, I'm going to watch The Counselor.
Oh, okay. Absolutely. All right, yeah. So now we're going to move on to The Counselor.
Which came out last year, 2013.
So I was so excited for this movie.
Dude, I saw it opening day, like your the poor Thursday wife. Night showing.
Your poor wife.
Like, I saw the trailer, I saw that, first of all, that cast, except Cameron Diaz, is fantastic.
It is, it's an excellent cast. What happened?
Ridley Scott is, in theory, a great director. Cormac McCarthy is a great writer. Everything about this movie should have worked. And then...
Well, it was such a big deal. It was like, oh my... Because, like, Cormac McCarthy basically just dropped this script into Hollywood out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And everyone was fighting over it. And it was, like, all over Variety. Like, Cormac McCarthy has written a fucking script.
Yeah.
Holy shit. Because he originally wrote No Country as a script. And then, at the last second, decided to make it a novel instead.
Okay, well, that worked out in his favor, but this did not, because I don't know how on earth you two were excited for this movie, because I saw the making of this film, you know, when you go to the movies and they show you, like, Coke commercials, right. And then...
You've been watching.
Yeah, that, in denial.
That mess. I watched the making of this film, and my wife and I looked at each other when we saw that Cameron Diaz mock... having sex with a car. Ugh. We looked at each other and almost Scooby-Dooed out of the theater before the movie even started.
You snaggle-pussed exit stage left.
This movie looks like trash. Shit even.
You got Ridley Scott directing, one of my favorite directors, Cormac McCarthy, and then Michael Fassbender playing the main character. It's like, Michael Fassbender's one of my favorite actors.
He's a great actor.
He's a great actor, except in this.
What on earth happened?
Do you have any tab pants?
Well, that's not even in the
And
movie.
You can't even... Like, normally, sometimes you can blame an actor's bad performance on the director, but Ridley Scott works with Michael Fassbender for Prometheus, and I would say the best thing in Prometheus is Michael Fassbender.
Yeah.
So it's not the director. I just don't know what the fuck happened.
See, I originally, after I watched it, I thought, I'm going to lay this all on Cormac McCarthy's feet, because... I didn't really see a problem with the direction, and the actors are acting fine, but their dialogue is just abysmal. But then I presented that to both of you, and Dave, do you remember what you said to me, Dave?
It was something very smart and poignant, but
yes.
I can't remember.
Okay. Yes, it was brilliant. You said that you think that Cormac, everybody saw that this was written by Cormac McCarthy, so they all thought that they could just show up and not do any work, and the script would just take care of itself.
That's what the film feels
like. And you're absolutely right. That's what it is. This is a joint effort of garbage. It's everybody's to blame on this one.
It's like when you had that group project in high school, and you had the smartest kid in the class in your group, so you were just like,
he'll do it.
I'm going to sleep the whole time. And then you woke up and got an F.
Yep. And that's right. This
that
movie
is an excellent
an
analogy.
That is the analogy, the only analogy that can apply to this film. This film gets an F minus.
It's a 4 out of 10.
What's that?
I would have given the if we had been a site back then, I would have given this a 4.
Really?
Yeah. It's better than Child of God. Give it 3.
There's a few things I like in the movie. I like... Spoiler. I like Brad Pitt's death.
Yes.
Because it's ridiculous.
Yes.
Brad Pitt gets killed by a contraption out of the Saw movies where...
You want to play a little game?
Well, it's a fucking Chekhov's... head noose.
I don't even
talk about it the whole
time. Several times in the film, Brad Pitt talks about
gun. It's just a head noose.
He talks about how like the
razor wire.
The Mexican cartel have this this contraption that they put around your neck and it tightens until it cuts your head off. And because it's Brad Pitt telling you the story, you're like, well, that's how he's gonna die, and that is how he dies.
Right.
And it's a wonderfully ridiculously gory scene.
I'll argue that it's not brutal because A, you see it coming from a mile away.
Oh, I think it's played for laughs, honestly.
And B, like, you have no attachment to Brad Pitt's character because
he's
barely in the film.
None.
I don't think he even has a fucking name in this movie. Let me look at the IMDb.
Long Hair McGillicuddy.
His name is Westray, according to IMDb.
All right, good for him. He has his long World War Z hair for some reason.
He's probably fucking filming World War Z at the same time and making $1 billion.
Absolutely.
So I will say this, though. The final scene of the movie is by far my favorite. I think it's the final scene. I haven't seen it in a while, but Michael Fassbender is just hiding out in Mexico looking for his wife. They were engaged.
I think it's his fiance.
His girlfriend.
And he knows that they took her.
Yeah.
And he knows that they killed her. And just one day in his hotel room, they deliver him a CDR that he
Ola on it.
Yeah. And he knows it's just a video of her getting her head chopped off.
Right.
It's just this fucking scene of him sitting there holding the CD and crying.
And they also had a conversation earlier in the film about if you were given a snuff film, would you watch it? And he says no, because it would implicate me in the murder. And so that's Chekhov's snuff film.
It's just fucking brutal, because it's like, oh my god, he's holding a video of his fiance getting her head chopped off.
And then they show her body being pushed into a dump.
Yeah.
By a bulldozer.
She falls under like a bulldozer.
That's the final scene, right?
Yeah,
that's the
final. And then the movie ends with her rolling down.
The movie ends and then I take my own life.
It's like Toy Story. Then she goes down in the furnace and the toys save her.
Yeah, it's exactly like that.
But everybody's terrible in this.
Especially, I think the MVP for terribleness is Cameron Diaz's character.
Well, you could say that about any film she's in.
Cameron Diaz's character, if played by a better actress, would be phenomenal. Because this character more or less orchestrates the entire film.
Yeah, and so we're to believe
she's like the lady. She's like the Lady Macbeth.
Yeah, we're to believe this old lady trying to play sexy.
All right.
Orchestrated this entire thing. Not buying it.
Yeah, she's bad.
Gold tooth. Like, is am I? What
oh, I fucking forgot about
is
that.
Is she supposed to be badass?
She's got a gold tooth and she's got like leopard tattoo spots.
No, she has two jaguars too. Like, oh,
yeah,
she's
literal two literal jaguar animals.
Here's the thing, though.
Also, yeah, she fucks a car at one point. Ugh. And I will say, while I don't like her fucking a car scene, I like Javier Bardem's performance during that scene because he looks mortified, which is, I think, appropriate when telling that story.
And he's describing it as though he was horrified watching her genitals smashed up against the glass, which I thought, I was like, oh, thank God that they did it this way, because I thought this scene was supposed to play as sexy.
Right.
I'm like, I do not want to see this old lady dragging her slit across the windshield.
Jesus!
Javier Bardem's character's kind of funny because he's like this ultra-rich guy who's just... he's trapped with Cameron Diaz.
He's got a goofy haircut again. That's the Cormac McCarthy staple.
The whole premise is that he's so scared of her, he just doesn't know what to do. He's married to her, and that's it.
Javier Bardem has now been in two Cormac McCarthy adaptations with a zany haircut.
Yeah.
And what are we doing? What is this?
He won an Oscar for The One, right?
Yeah. So what? So he thought he was going
to
get that?
Go back to that well.
Yeah, that sort of feels like that's what they did. They were like, oh, we need to give him a goofy haircut because he had one in the other movie.
But what else has he been in that he's been particularly good in?
I don't know. I think he's a fairly good actor.
Yeah, in No Country for Old Men, he's great.
He was in a Woody Allen movie.
He's a goofball. Right? Well,
he was good in that. And Vicky Cristina Barcelona, he was actually very good in that.
All right. I was just literally, I was genuinely asking.
Left and right. Oh!
Is that Andrew Dice Clay or Woody Allen?
It was a little bit of both.
It's Alan Dice Clay.
Yeah, and he was in that one movie that Woody Allen directed.
Blue Jasmine.
So, yeah. I will say this. While watching The Counselor, it was occurring to me, I was like, I can see how this is a really good Cormac McCarthy novel that I'll never get to read.
I wish this had been made a novel first.
And edited many times over.
Well, because there are moments, like, Cameron Diaz's character with the Jaguars and all that, like, build up with his prose could be horrifying.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. He's such a good writer that even if he's writing something mundane, it'll be great just because he is such a great grasp on the language.
But not only that, Michael Fassbender's character has, like, an obsession with diamonds. And like that felt like a good character trait for a character in a Cormac McCarthy novel.
Yeah.
But on the screen, it just plays strange because
he's terrible in this film. Yeah. Michael Fassbender is absolutely awful.
He doesn't fit the film. That's the problem.
Nope. He's a fish out of water here.
All right. That's enough about that.
You're just wiping your hands clean of this filth and muck.
Yeah.
But there is the behemoth Blood Meridian.
Right.
Yes.
Cormac McCarthy's undisputed greatest novel.
Masterpiece.
It's.
And let me just say for the record, I hope this never gets turned into a film. It will someday, but I just don't want it to
it's be. It's arguably the greatest American novel. I think the only other ones that dispute it are Moby Dick.
I'd say this is the greatest modern American novel, written in the last,
But even, American novel period, Moby Dick is the only one that really stands up to it. And they're essentially the same story in ways, which is cool.
Yeah. This is basically unfilmable.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt unfilmable. And thank God Ridley Scott was attached at one point.
Yes, he was. Oh, Lord Almighty.
And yeah, I like Ridley Scott, but no.
He's not the man.
He is not the man.
I like Ridley Scott, too. He's not the guy.
He's not the man to make this film, especially after The Counselor.
Blood Meridian, if you haven't read it, read it, first of all.
Yeah.
But it's about, it follows this character who's just called The Kid.
Right.
And he joins the Glanton gang.
Billy Bob Thornton, The Kid.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. not at all. He joins this gang after he's, I guess he's sprung out of prison.
Yeah, the Glanton gang.
The Glanton gang.
This is it's historical, it's historical fiction.
1849 through 1850.
A lot of the characters in the book were real characters.
Yeah,
but
the Glanton gang was real.
Yeah.
And basically the gang scalps Indians for bounty.
For money, yeah. They travel across the plains.
Until they just spin off into the... the atmosphere, and they start killing for joy.
Yeah.
They just start killing anyone and scalping them.
Yeah,
they're not
just scalping Indians. Now they're scalping ally Indians.
Right,
and
yeah.
Mexican...
There's whole villages of
villages,
people.
Yeah. Or just pure... Yeah, they would just scalp anyone. And
just pass off the scalps, basically.
Just for the hell of it.
During that time, the American government would pay money for every scalp you gave them of a combatant Indian tribe.
Right, which
is
where
fucking horrifying.
It is. Right. And now we have a football team to honor that tradition. That fine tradition.
And that's the cool thing about the novel. I think is the point. One of the points of the novel is to bring to light this horrible
and
fucking
this is
history.
An absolute horror story.
It's an anti-Western,
novel.
Is like what you would say.
I've heard
it
bandied about.
Yeah, it deconstructs the Western genre, basically.
Yeah.
It doesn't. It's like whereas Western films, a lot of Western films present the Western genre as this big sweeping romantic thing. This book is no, it was horrifying.
Yep.
This is a horror novel.
You want to see how what No Law looks like?
Yeah.
This is it.
Yeah, Harold Bloom, who is pretty much the authority on literary criticism, has called this the ultimate Western. He's there will never be anything ever again written that does anything for the Western genre.
What about Wagons East?
No. And this was written in 1985.
Yeah.
So, and I will agree, since then, nothing has even come close to... Maybe No Country is a modern Western.
Yeah. It's,
and that's a totally different genre.
Yeah.
So we were thinking of, casting.
Yeah.
Even though we all agree this should not be a movie because it's unfilmable.
Who would we like to see in it?
Right.
And behind the scenes.
Exactly. Who would we want to
direct? Would be the key grip? Dave, you go.
Me. Because I'd want to be there.
Oh,
all right. Okay. So there's a character in the in Blood Meridian called the Judge.
Right, who is one of the greatest literary characters you can think of.
Yeah, he is
he's pure evil, basically.
He's a specter.
He's the physical representation of pure evil is what this character is.
Yeah, not even Satan. He's he's more evil.
Yeah, he's not any sort of religious. He's the physical representation of this, the act of evil is pushed into this character.
He convinces a mob of people to kill a priest for killing having sex with a young girl and a goat.
Right.
And he just makes it up.
Yeah.
Right.
And he's so good at orating.
And just everything about this character is just, I think he's 7 feet tall in the book.
Yeah.
He has alopecia, which means he has no hair at all.
And
he's no eyebrows.
White.
Yeah.
There's a scene in the novel where he...
he's also naked a lot.
Yeah, just walking around with his cock out.
Because I reread the novel recently, and I was he's naked in every scene.
Yeah. He needs a pair of britches.
Well, that's where the Moby Dick comparison comes in. He's supposed to be the white whale.
Oh, his Moby Dick is hanging out.
Can you explain that analogy further?
No, he's the alopecia. He's all white. He's the white whale. Okay. He's fucking giant.
Oh, I thought you were making a Moby Dick joke.
No, no, that's kind of funny, though.
Thanks.
His Moby Dick. There's a scene in the novel where they go into one of the many Mexican towns that they go into and just slaughter everybody. But in this scene, he buys a litter of puppies.
Oh, this scene. This is the most upsetting scene in the novel for me.
Puts them into a bag and just tosses them into the river.
And then another, I think it's Toadvine, shoots them.
Yeah, from the bridge, right. just shooting them.
Yeah, the character Toadvine, right. who is in jail with the kid.
He's also unique because he has no ears.
Yes.
He's a cool character.
Right. He is.
There's Toadvine, the priest, the kid.
Glanton.
Glanton himself.
What's the little creature that's with them?
They just call him, like, the fool or something like that.
And there's two guys with the same last name. One's black, one's white.
Oh, it's like David. I think David Brown is the name or something like that.
That's funny.
But, I was just thinking of casting.
Oh, no, no. I'm just trying to explain how evil it is. There's, like, this weird freak guy who's with them. He's, like,
he's mentally retarded, basically.
Yeah, and, like, deformed, too.
He's, like, Snark. From Thundercats.
But it's implied.
Snarf, whatever his name is. I don't know. I'm 31 years old.
When they finally settle down, like, if you could call it settling down, when they take over that bridge thing, the toll, it's implied that the judge is just, like, fucking this little creature guy.
It's in
because
there.
They're, like, living in the same room together.
I mean, there's also this running thing that the judge is both a pedophile and child killer.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Because basically every village they go to...
Children end up dead.
Yeah, first thing that happens is, like, a child disappears.
And it's just alluded to so nonchalantly.
Yeah.
Like, nobody has a problem in this gang. This man is killing
Except
children.
For the kid who's, like... Yeah, I mean, you're supposed to be seeing the story.
Well, he's brutal, too.
Yeah, yeah. The kid's not... innocent.
He's the least.
Like he's no Cypher. This is not us.
No, he's the least awful
he's
of everyone.
Me.
Oh well, I think we need to find a new partner.
Anyway, so we want to cast the judge and the kid, the main character, and then this evil dude, and then say who we would want to direct it.
Yeah.
I would cast the judge as Michael Shannon.
That's good.
That's good. I mean, he's a tall guy, but I always pictured the judge as being, like, heavier.
Like, flabby, right?
Not like obese, but, like, you know, like some masculinity to him.
I'm picturing Michael Shannon shave his head, have him gain a few pounds, and then, like...
He definitely needs to
maybe
carb up.
Maybe, like, boost him up in post, like... Well, height wise,
I was gonna. I'm not gonna say my
put
actor
him on moon
yet.
Shoes,
but,
Nickelodeon moon shoes.
But basically, I would say the way you should do the judge is the same way they did Gandalf in the Lord of the Rings movies, where he looks
like force perspective.
Yeah, force perspective, where he looks bigger than he is.
Yeah, that would be a good way to do it.
I can't think of any actor who is 7 feet tall. So.
No. Vince Vaughn, maybe.
Yeah, perhaps
he's terrific.
Perhaps Manute Bol can play the judge.
Or maybe
Bol. He's just doing layups.
Or maybe if the CGI ever gets good enough, you could have Andy Serkis play him.
Motion capture the judge.
And then just beef him up and pose.
Just this giant, giant CGI man. Judge, no, kill.
He's just forever locked in Caesar.
He can't, that's the only thing he knows how to play.
For the judge, my pick was Clancy Brown.
Ooh, that's
I don't
a
know
good
who
one.
That is.
He's the... not the warden, but he's the
he is a great character.
Head guard in Shawshank.
He's he's in Highlander. Have you ever seen that?
He's also in Carnival. He plays the brother.
Oh, okay,
Justin.
Yeah, this guy I've seen him before.
He's one of those actors like you see him and you're like, oh, that guy.
He's enormous. He's a fantastic actor, and he always plays a menacing character.
Yeah.
He's got the judge face, and he almost has the Michael Shannon face. They have that same.
He's
like,
he's got a crazy
weird
but
look to them.
Composed. Like it's composed, crazy look to him, and he's like he's a big guy, like he's a manly man. He's got like broad shoulders, and it's what I picture the judge as.
Like if he was standing there naked with his dick out, like
I'd say, sir, this
please,
is no way to
please
no,
put these pants on.
You're at a restaurant, sir.
Please get out of the Chili's with your dick out.
I pick Clancy Brown as the judge.
That's a good pick.
Thank you.
I think I know who Chris is going to pick.
My pick is Dave Costell.
Oh, boy. Not even an actor.
My pick is actually Daniel Day-Lewis.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Like, I think of Daniel Day-Lewis in There Will Be Blood. I think of that character, but a million times meaner.
Okay.
And again, I picture him, you know, in post, made to look bigger.
Yeah.
I picture him with no hair. I picture that in my head. And I picture that voice he used from There Will Be Blood as the judge.
That is the voice I hear.
And I just think that would be fucking terrifying to see him do, because he's such a great actor. He could fucking do anything.
He does look pretty wicked with no hair.
Yes, he does.
So, like, picture Daniel Day-Lewis with absolutely no hair, no eyebrows, made in post to look like he's 7 feet tall.
Done. Pictured.
Talking in that Daniel Plainview voice.
Okay. I would, if we were multimillionaires on a board right now, I think I'd go with Chris's pick.
All right.
Thanks, everyone.
If
I really like Clancy Brown. I hadn't even thought of that because I was thinking bigger. But
I'm just a big Clancy Brown
fan.
He's
a great actor.
I cast him as the kid, too.
Daniel Day-Lewis ties into my director, and I would without a doubt want Paul Thomas Anderson to make this movie.
I thought about Paul Thomas Anderson.
I have actually four names on my list, and
okay.
he's on there.
I'm
Ridley
glad
Scott.
You have more.
Well, do we want to do the director, or do we want to do the kid?
I would.
Let's do director, because you brought it
yeah,
up.
Yeah, I brought it
you
up.
You already spilled the beans.
Yeah.
So let me pick the beans up.
And I kind of sat there and thought for a while, and because I'm like, Paul Thomas Anderson is such like a, it almost feels hack at this point, because There Will Be Blood in many ways, like the early scenes of There Will Be Blood feel like a Blood Meridian
yeah.
adaptation. So it felt lazy, but at the same time, like, that's perfect to me. Those scenes, like, they're quiet. A lot of the scenes in Blood Meridian are quiet,
yeah.
and it just sits there, and it isn't afraid to be what it is,
right,
the
right.
same way There Will Be Blood is.
Yeah. All right. Well, my pick for director is
Bobcat Goldthwait.
While as good as he is, I went one step above and picked Jon Favreau. I'm kidding.
I was about to leave.
Chris, come back. He was joking.
Why are you yelling? He didn't leave. It was just theater of the mind. I picked the Coen brothers. I thought about Paul Thomas Anderson, but I liked what they did with No Country, and I thought, I want them to do that with this.
I mean, traditionally, they're the only ones who have gotten Cormac McCarthy right, so I
and
can't disagree.
I was looking at, like, Western directors and who did this, but everybody just made these goofy Westerns.
Right.
John
and True
Ford.
Grit was good, too.
Yeah. I didn't love True Grit, but
It was well done.
It was well done. I didn't love it. But yeah, I picked the Coens.
And if they would be able to inject a little bit of humor into Blood Meridian, it could be amazing. Like
yeah.
Coen brother humor, I mean.
Right. Yeah, because it is there. There is
yeah,
some
it's definitely
humor.
There.
Right.
But, yeah, Coen brothers.
Like when the guy's pissing and gets shot in the dick with an arrow
Perfect.
Out of nowhere.
Hilarious.
Yuck, 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 I say.
So,
who'd you pick?
All right, so I did have Paul Thomas Anderson. My one caveat for Paul Thomas Anderson is he's never made anything this violent.
That's why I didn't go with him.
So I don't know if he can pull that off. So I had four names on my list. Paul Thomas Anderson is one of them. Another one is Andrew Dominik, who directed The Assassination of Jesse James.
Yeah, okay.
So
yeah, he could definitely pull that
he
off.
He could pull off
That's a sprawling movie in
right.
the same way that this is a
That has
sprawling
that same sort
novel.
Of thing. But again, that is also not as crazy as
right.
it needs to be. So here are the last two.
Hold on, before you go, can I say something?
Go ahead.
I think that Blood Meridian would have to be a Volume 1, Volume 2.
Yeah,
situation
really?
Because I think the novel's even broken up that way where like because the Glanton gang kind of breaks up towards the end, so the back half could be
that's true, and they aren't together until about a third of the way through
yeah.
the book, so you could
just
you
do
could
the
follow
kid.
The kid to when he and Toadvine are in prison, and then they break
that
out
that scene's awesome when they're
yes,
in Chihuahua
it
City
so it's kind of like The Hobbit but horrifying
but good
yeah so all right the last two are all right. One is David Fincher, just because I really want to see a David Fincher Western, just because I want to see
fun.
That.
And a David Fincher, like, that's not
And he's
modern.
Not afraid. He's not afraid of violent either.
No.
He's actually very good at violence.
But at the same time, I don't know if he can do something like this, because even though this movie needs to be cold, it's a different kind of cold than David Fincher directs.
Okay.
It's a different kind of cold than it exists in the cinema landscape.
Right.
Period.
Yes.
Which is tough.
All right. Yeah. So my last pick is he's kind of a wild card because he hasn't done anything good in a long time. But I'm thinking back to his early career.
Tim Burton.
Yes. No. I'm going to pick, I think if I...
Harold Ramis.
If I absolutely... Yeah. Harold Ramis' skeleton.
He has ceased to be.
I would pick Francis Ford Coppola.
Ooh.
Based on, one,
his good movies.
Apocalypse Now, yeah. Which I think is the perfect tone for Blood Meridian.
And Twixt.
And you kind of just gave me goosebumps because I just said the kind of cold that right. doesn't
Get
exist.
Get that goose out of here.
Like, I'm picturing Francis Ford Coppola insanity of Apocalypse Now, and I'm also picturing the insanity of his adaptation of Dracula, which I love. And that is a weird,
it
insane movie.
But that's exactly the tone I think this kind of needs in places, like, that craziness.
In my head, I picture that music from Dracula, that insane, loud music
yes!
over a trailer for Blood Meridian, and I get like a hard-on for this movie.
Well, let me massage
but
that.
Holy fuck, Marlon Brando from Apocalypse Now
as
he's
the judge.
Judge.
Yeah, exactly.
He's just covered in flies at this moment.
But like, is he not the judge?
Everybody's throwing
you
up.
For me. That was my Marlon Brando.
Not good.
That was like Watto from from episode one, I believe.
Your space credits are no good here.
Could you do that for the rest of the podcast?
Yes, I will.
The next 10.
Let's put some space music under it. Fuck, Marlon Brando was that pudgy, like,
yeah.
that out of shape, in shape thing you're
yeah.
talking about.
Yeah.
Oh,
so yeah.
Fuck, we just need to hologram him. We'll use the Tupac.
Yeah. So I don't know if Francis Ford Coppola still has that in him, but back in the day, Francis Ford Coppola would be
I think all he has in him is sandwiches and wine.
Yeah, producing his wine. All right, so the kid who
we'll just get Sophia to direct it.
No, we won't.
No, please no. So,
yeah, just be a twee indie.
Yeah, the Strokes playing over every fucking scene.
What is this?
All right, so the kid. Who would you have play the kid, Dave?
I know this is...
I'm not going to like it.
The kid from Problem Child.
No, I know...
Junior Healy.
This is controversial,
all right.
To say the least.
Hitler.
But because... and
young Hitler as the kid.
The Lindbergh baby.
That's cute.
I don't think you know how movies work.
Okay, can I say my pick?
Yeah, go ahead,
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Because of his performance in a movie I haven't even seen, I've only seen the trailers for it, but I would pick Robert Pattinson.
Wow.
The trailers for The Rover,
right.
While watching it, he felt like the kid to me. Like that 16-year-old who's older... because it's 1850
yeah.
and when you're 16 you're actually 25
yeah because your life's almost over yeah. when you're 16 in that era
you're middle age
yeah
and he has that look that like skinny but like
emaciated
yeah but kind of like someone who would fit into this gang of
I don't dislike Robert Pattinson's acting at all. I haven't seen The Rover, but like, I have seen the first Twilight film and
he's the best part
he's
of it.
Not the worst part.
Yeah.
Put it that way.
I think he has like a great performance in him, and this actually would be good for him to show that.
Yeah.
I'm not going to disagree with that. That's a good pick.
Yeah.
I win!
For me, I'm going to give my pick for the kid, Toadvine, and Glanton, because
okay.
I don't want to drag this on for two more hours.
Yeah.
For the kid, I pick either Casey Affleck, because he has that young look to him.
Yeah, but right.
He's too old now, but
I'm,
yeah.
I'm picturing Casey Affleck.
And again, that ties
the assassination
into yeah, yeah.
Jesse James.
That's the perfect way to play that character.
And I think, like, fuck it. Like, you have to make compromises. And I would rather. I don't know. That's a tough one. I love Casey Affleck.
I do too.
So I could see him in that role.
Yeah.
My other pick for the kid was Elijah Wood.
Ooh.
Because he's perpetually 16
yeah,
years
old. He hasn't aged in 35 years, I
yes.
believe.
He looks the same now as he did in North.
Yeah, he's not
flick.
Good,
and
though.
The Good Son.
Ooh.
He hasn't been good since Lord of the Rings.
I liked him in Grand Piano. I thought he was actually enjoyable
in that. I
didn't
see that.
I'm going to give my pick for Toadvine.
Go for it.
It's Paul Dano. Yay, nay, nobody?
Well,
I mean, Paul Dano needs to be in this movie.
He looks lizard-like.
Paul Dano could be the priest. But
I have like a list of people I want in this movie, and it's like Gary Oldman. I don't know where, but I want him in this movie.
Gary Oldman could be the priest, because the priest is an older character.
That would be good.
And for Glanton, he's the only other person I cast, Ian McShane.
Ooh.
He was Al Swearengen in Deadwood.
That's a good one.
That's pretty good.
He's fucking a phenomenal actor.
He is.
And he's mean. He's the perfect guy to lead this gang.
He'd actually even be a good judge.
Yeah, I thought about that, but I pictured that dark black hair and mustache, and I want that in the movie.
Yeah.
So, yeah, those are my picks.
Bill Paxton could be a good Glenn.
How about Pill Baxton?
Yeah, put him right in your back.
All
right.
All right. So I have two picks for the kid. One of them actually is Paul Dano.
Perfect.
But I'm thinking younger Paul Dano. Like, since this is a metaphorical movie that will never exist.
Right.
This movie probably will exist.
Well, not this version.
A version.
The younger Paul Dano will be perfect for this. Another actor who's too old now, but I think would actually be good younger, is Aaron Paul from Breaking Bad.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even think about that. That would be excellent.
Oh, yeah.
Like a young... He's too old now because he looks like he's like...
I don't even know, though, because like I was saying that, like 25...
Yeah, but he's got like that receding hairline.
That's the problem.
He looks older now.
His hair's receding. Like, he's got like a widow's peak.
I'm thinking Aaron Paul from like the pilot of Breaking Bad would be perfect for this.
Yeah, that he would be.
And I'll just say my...
Do you have anyone else?
Yeah, so my Toad Vine would actually be Sam Rockwell.
Ooh.
With no ears, which would I think would be fantastic.
Yeah, he would.
Sam Rockwell needs to be in
the movie. Sam Rockwell needs to be in the movie somewhere. And then the actor I would pick for Glanton, he might be a little too young, but I would pick Jason Clarke, because I think he's actually a really good actor.
I'm not familiar
with
him.
He's in the newest Planet of the Apes movie. He's the human.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oh God.
And he's also in Zero Dark Thirty. He's like the main torturer guy.
No, but you could like old him up. And he would be...
He's another actor. If he's not that character, I want him in this movie somewhere.
I can see him in
I'm
that.
Funding Chris's.
Chris's Blood Meridian.
But there's...
It'll only cost $10 million.
There's an actor I'd want in this movie that I don't know where to put him.
Howie Mandel.
Hey, I'm the voice of the judge.
not the actor, just the voice.
He didn't even know the name of the character. Howard, would you please leave?
Miles Teller. He's not the kid, but he should be in the movie. And I think that there is a younger gang member.
Yeah, there is. There's several gang members.
Yeah, because there's somebody who the kid relates, who dies early on. Miles Teller would be good in this, because I love him.
He's a good
Literally,
actor.
Literally, I'm in love with him.
Well, I know.
Interesting.
I think that's it. I have nothing else to say about Blood Meridian.
No, I don't either.
Except
I can't wait till they make it a terrible movie, because they will.
That fucking scene when the gang splits up finally and they're all just on the run from the judge is so horrifying. It feels like Jaws.
It is.
But with a person.
The judge is like Jaws who talks, basically.
Yes,
I just called the shark Jaws. Fucking deal with it.
Well, it's Tim Jaws. This is a Christian name.
Blood Meridian would actually be better served as an HBO series that a single director did True Detective style.
I don't even know at this point. I just don't think anyone can pull this off.
If you could convince, who is your director?
Francis Ford Coppola.
Yeah, to do HBO's Blood Meridian.
I might 10 watch episodes. That actually would be kind of cool.
It would be perfect.
I just know that if the movie adaptation isn't done right, I will loathe it. Even if the movie's not bad, I'll just hate it. Just because it's so hard to capture. And that ending scene where the judge is just dancing and everyone's dancing around him.
And he's naked again.
And there's a bear playing an accordion.
If you pulled that scene.
Yeah, I had to read that scene, that passage so many times to figure out, what the hell am I reading?
Because like in my head, I picture people going out to the outhouse and they see something in it and we don't see what it is because the book doesn't show us. And I just picture them in that saloon and everyone's dancing in this. If they did that right, it would be the most terrifying
ending. Do you have
ending.
An interpretation of that? Because I do. The kid finds the judge raping the girl. And then the judge kills the kid.
That's how I interpret it.
The judge kills the kid and the people find the kid and the girl dead in the...
I honestly think the judge sexually assaults the kid in
that
scene.
So do I,
But not just the kid... The little girl...
Because she goes... The girl who owns the bear is missing. Right, yeah.
Because there's, like, a little girl playing an accordion and a bear, like, dancing.
And then someone shoots the bear.
Yeah, because it goes nuts.
Right.
Because the girl's missing. And the judge is missing.
Right.
And the kid was, like, fucking a prostitute or something at the time. It's very,
He has sex with a prostitute who's also a midget. That's what happens.
Yeah. That's it.
But he's not a kid anymore.
No, they call him the man at this point in the book. Because it's, like, many years... That's the other thing, like... The kid has aged, but the judge has not, which is also terrifying.
It's so bizarre. Yeah, that's about it for casting Blood Meridian. Yeah. Shall we recommend some movies?
Yeah, let's recommend some movies. Cooper Film is watching. They see every movie. Cooper Film is watching. They see every movie. Watching them, watching them, watching them, watching them, watching them, watching them. Yeah!
Oh, good God.
Yeah!
I didn't really have the same energy as Daryl Hall.
No,
but.
I don't even think you were singing the same song that was playing.
Never quite on time.
Never. Not even close.
That's what makes it great.
Yeah, we love ye for it.
They see every movie.
Oh, we're getting a live show here. Yeah, we've seen every movie.
Watching you. Yeah!
I don't think they say yeah at the end of that song.
No. But I'll never hear it the same way again. Who's going first?
I'm going to recommend Shane Carruth's Upstream Color.
Ooh. I hated this, but go on.
I haven't watched it.
Is this thing on?
Yeah, okay. It is. We just podcasted for an hour and a half.
Shane Carruth is the guy who directed Primer.
Which I love.
And starred in.
Yes.
And then he disappeared for like 7 years.
Well, he built that time machine. Yeah. Primer was a true story.
And then he came back on the scene with another self-funded movie. It wasn't self-funded, but it was pretty cheap.
Right.
And he released it via iTunes. It was one of the first people to do this, like straight to iTunes release. And it did rather well. I think he's working on another movie now. But this film is called Upstream Color, and it's a science fiction film. But at the same time, it's like very meditative. And would you say meditative, Chris?
I would also say it's very jerk offy. Is that a phrase?
It's a bullshit hassle is what Chris is saying.
But I don't like Tree of Life either, and this feels like a
I like Tree of Life.
I'm the one that hates Tree of Life.
I like Tree of Life, and I love Primer. I think Primer is fantastic, but I just couldn't get behind this movie.
It follows a guy who grows these little earworms, and
I don't even know what the fuck this movie is about.
So they grow these worms and then poisons people with them, and then they have ultimate power of suggestion. Like, he then gets them to clear out all their bank accounts, and it spends like 30 days doing all this erratic behavior with the person, and then just abandons them, and then they wake up and their whole life's ruined,
right.
And they don't know how, and people are like, you were probably on drugs the whole time, or like no one realizes,
right.
But then the movie follows two people who are both victims of this, and they're drawn together because of their shared experience, but they don't even realize it.
That sounds fascinating.
It sounds a lot better than it is.
It kind of like alters their genetics a little bit to the point where they're like a different organism, so they're attracted to each other. But it's also like horrible for them because they have no idea what happened to them. And it's very creepy. It's not like, you know what it reminds me of? And I'm surprised that you don't like it, but it's very similar to Under the Skin in the direction and the way that the film doesn't explain everything to you. It's just there.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is about this movie, because I generally like movies like this. But just this movie, I watched it, and when it was over, I was like, fuck this movie.
I feel like even if you don't like it, it's worth watching.
I mean, it looks great. It's well-directed. It's gorgeous.
Shane Carruth is, without a doubt, knows what he's doing.
I would in no way, shape, or form call this a bad movie. I just do not like it.
Okay.
Okay. Oh, the Boogans are back?
Yeah, the Boogans.
The Boogans, they see your every movie.
They see you every Boogans.
I'll go. My pick is the 1994 film Heavenly Creatures, directed by Peter Jackson before he lost his whatever it is he had.
His spark.
Yeah. So
his muse had a coronary.
So Heavenly Creatures is a true story. It's based on these two girls in Australia. I think it's in the 50s. And they fell in love with each other. And back then, it was like, oh, well, homosexuality, it's a medical condition. So
Right. Doctors
keep trying to cure them. They keep trying to split them up. And basically, these two girls, together they build this sort of insane fantasy world where they rule over their own kingdom. And Peter Jackson, back when he was making interesting movies, this film is filled with all these weird special effects of like people made of clay coming to life. And it's all done practically. And basically, because everyone keeps trying to split them up, these two girls, they basically just plan to kill the mother of one of the girls. And, I mean, I don't think it's a spoiler because it's based on a true story and it happens in the first scene and then you flash back. They just kill the mother.
Okay.
And as a result, they get separated forever. And one of the stipulations of the murder is they're never allowed to see each other again. And it's this weird, unique, it's just different. It's unlike any movie.
It sounds good.
Kate Winslet is in it back before she got really famous. Melanie Lynskey is in it. She's in a lot of like indie films now, but she's in this. She was in Happy Christmas.
Oh, yeah, I know who you're talking about.
But it's a really good movie. There's like this half hour sequence where the two girls go to see the third man, and then they come out of the movie and they get chased around like the city by Orson Welles, who's in black and white, and he's just chasing them around.
Oh, that sounds good.
And it's just such a weird, different movie. And
is he wearing dress shoes chasing them through wet alleys?
Exactly. It's like shot like the third man chasing
them.
What
year is this? Like 94?
94. Yeah, 94. That
sounds great.
Yes.
And I think it's on Netflix. It's really good.
I will check it out.
Heavenly Creatures.
It's my turn, everybody.
Thanks, Boogans.
Oh, Upstream Color is on Netflix, too.
Oh, good.
No, what? No, Dave, no.
You don't have control over that. I control the Boogans. My pick is also on Netflix. It came out last year. It's called We Are What We Are.
Ooh.
It's a horror film. Did you see it?
It's in my queue. I just haven't seen it yet.
Watch it. It's been in my queue for...
I have it queued up, mate.
Yeah, all right, good. It's been in my queue for like 3 months. I just watched it the other night. It's fantastic. It's directed by Jim Mickle, who did Stakeland and... Cold in July,
yes.
Which you reviewed and liked.
I loved
year.
Cold in July. I like Stakeland too, but Cold in July.
Cold in July
great.
Got a 9, right?
Yeah,
it was great. Cold in July is great.
You can see why he's so good in this film because he is great with a camera. He moves it away from things that are happening so you don't have to see, and then he moves it back in the frame. It's artfully done. It's an arty horror film, and it does. One of my favorite things that horror films do is it masks a movie about anxieties.
Right. As horror.
By making it a horror movie and making it about something else. But if you dig a little
deeper. Kind of like The Babadook.
Yes, like The Babadook.
Kind of like The Boogies.
Exactly like Chud. It stars Amber Childer, Julia Garner, and Bill Sage, who are indie actors.
Yeah, I've never heard of any of them.
They're all three of them are excellent.
Really?
Yeah, in this and other works.
From the East Indies?
No. Nope. Those are Native Americans that we're talking about here. Not at all, actually. These are white people. These are white men. It's about a family who follow an ancient custom, which I'm not going to give away. And they find that their secret existence is threatened when the town floods and a deputy starts poking his nose around. And it's really creepy and really scary. And
they're vampires.
It's really good. They're not vampires.
Damn it.
They are all Frankenstein monsters.
Wait. They're all mummies.
So, yeah, my pick is 2013's We Are What We Are. It is on Netflix.
We are what we are, and we is what we is.
Yeah, they're all pirates. That's the twist. Arr, we are what we are.
Oh, it's
well,
that time.
Well.
I just ate my mop head.
What?
I'm sick, guys. I don't feel well.
You ate that mop head.
Stay in your seats until the seatbelt light goes off.
Seatbelt light.
Coming next week on the podcast is episode 1 in our Brian De Palma series.
Right, we're going to start focusing podcasts on specific directors. Because the summer is dead, everyone.
Yes. It's the fall director series.
Lasers. A baseball gets hit.
Fireworks. Someone eats one Cracker Jack. Singular.
The crowd howls.
An orange gets squeezed. Anyway... Next week, we're going to be talking exclusively about Brian De Palma's film Sisters. And I think I'm the only one that's seen it so far.
I've seen it.
Okay, are you going to watch it again?
Yeah, I will get it from the library.
Yes.
So if you're an avid Cut Print Film podcast listener and you want to keep up with next week, you should watch Sisters this week.
Yes, Brian De Palma's Sisters. It's on Hulu Plus. It's part of their Criterion Collection. And it's also part of the Criterion Collection.
Yes.
If you like to buy $45 Blu-rays, why don't you pick up Sisters?
And you can get all this stuff and more at cutprintfilm.com.
That's where we review movies.
That's our website that we work on every day. Every day.
For your eyeballs.
Please.
And we do this podcast for your earballs.
Well, like they say, it's the destination, not the journey.
That's right.
Who says that?
Which, I guess, in this case, it is the journey. The journey was the podcast.
What's the destination?
It's the end of the podcast.
Like my grandfather said, the treatments aren't working. Please kill me.
He was a wise man.
I'm in great pain.
I can't say the things my grandfather said on this podcast. Well, everybody, it's been fun. I hope you enjoyed our literary discussion on Cormac McCarthy.
And if you didn't, I hope you never come back.
Read a book, you cretins.
Every now and then, we gotta pause and not talk about the poppiest movies in the world.
That's right. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles came out this week, and this is the only time we're even talking about it.
Yeah, we didn't even see it. Why would we?
And
we're adults.
That's right.
We don't need to see that.
That piano's dying out. And that's the end of the show.
I think we'll just be done.
I think we're done now.
Yeah.
Wait. Now we're done.